Not because politicians are stupid. It's not because they're dishonest, that they are terrified of the public. They don't want to say the truth. The truth is the current direction is unsustainable.
That's quite something, Dan Needle.
People are in favour of a wealth tax.
These are traps the left should not be going down.
More than 20 years at Clifford Chance as head of tax.
You're choosing a status quo that is getting worse and worse every year. We have more and more elderly people who have to be paid for, so we cut other stuff and taxes go up.
Dan Needle is the man whose own investigation into Nadeem Zahawi's taxes, for which he was threatened with legal action, a scandal that has now cost Mr. Zahawi his job in the government.
What do you say to those people who are working so hard and who see a concentration of wealth at the top?
Gary Stevenson will always say tax assets, not income.
It's about assets. We talk about assets over 10 million.
This was a socialist stroke communist coalition. They also didn't want to fuck up the economy. And so they did something which they can say is a wealth tax, but isn't really truly taxing wealth.
And I've annoyed politicians of all four main parties.
The Treasury knows it. HMRC knows it. The politicians know it.
Everyone knows it, but then we don't do
it. But they won't do it.
Now, he's a tax dodger's worst enemy.
His money comes from tax avoidance schemes.
They're going to threaten you with libel.
Yeah, well, he didn't. Why do you think he didn't? Because it's true.
Do you think now is the moment for the government to finally be bold? What's left? Newest episode with the eminent tax expert in UK politics, Dan Needle. Welcome to the show.
Morning.
Obviously, the first thing we have to talk to you about is this new polling's come out, which has said that 75% of people are in favour of a wealth tax. Now, to be honest with you, we're not economists, which is part of the reason we've got a tax expert on, but I think, broadly speaking, I am in favour.
Well, I'm in favour of it.
You're in favour, yeah. I mean,
put my cards on the table.
I think we're broadly in favour of wealth tax, but I think you're about to set us straight.
Well, I mean, the opinion polling goes, are you in favour of a tax on people with £10 million or more of net wealth, and it will raise £24 billion? And if that's all it did, sounds great. Yeah, I mean, it's free money. We need $24 billion.
Was it 2% that they're saying over those assets?
Yeah, yeah. If it's 2% is a tiny amount, what's not to like? And so if you ask it like that, and if that was all it is, yeah, count me in favour. But probably the two most important principles in economics. First one is people follow incentives, and there are always trade-offs. There's an upside, there's a downside. If someone's selling you something, and they don't tell you what the trade-off is, even worse, they haven't thought about the trade-off, then you need to be hugely suspicious. There's no free lunch. There's never anything for nothing. So what are the trade-offs here? And are the trade-offs worth it, or are they not? So income tax. Income tax has a cost. By having income tax, it makes work less attractive, and that's a bad thing. If we could magically get rid of income tax without a cost, you would do it in a heartbeat. But of course, we need income tax to fund the state services that we want. So what does a wealth tax actually do? And is that a price worth paying?
Is it naive for people like myself to be calling for a wealth tax when we need to fund all of these public services and yet people have less money probably now than they probably had in the last 40 years?
Wealth tax is a tax on investment. It's a tax on savings. If you tax something, you get less of it. So one of the reasons I was so opposed to the government raising employer national insurance is that you are taxing employment. The result is, ta-da, less employment.
A job tax.
Yeah. So that was the tax that raised 20 billion, was it, in the last budget?
Yeah. 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 So I would have done something that's much better to raise income tax, because the end result in the long term is going to be the same, but you don't have disruption in the job market in the short term. So that would have been a better thing to do. Wealth tax, it's more subtle. You're not taxing jobs, you're taxing investment and savings. Now, if you look at the figures that the wealth tax proponents use and you dig into them, you see they imply a loss of between 200 billion and 500 billion of capital. Not my figures. The data they rely on implies that. Now, that is a consequence. And people have crunched the numbers. No one's actually crunched the numbers on these proposals. They should do, but they haven't. People did analyse similar US wealth tax proposals and a similar German wealth tax proposals. And they saw a long-run hit to GDP of 2% in the US, 5% in Germany.
Is that because these rich people would just, like, leave?
I don't think talking about people leaving is a... I mean, I know that's the framing the media likes, is kind of dramatic. And that is part of it. But it's more that if you have 100 quid and you could spend it or save it and have 110 quid in a year's time, you might save it. If you've got 100 quid and you can save it and have 98 in a year's time, you're not going to save it. You're going to spend it.
I'm going to spend that money. I'm spending it.
You're going to spend that money. So a wealth tax means at the margins, as economists say, you're less likely to invest. You're more likely to maybe spend it, maybe put it into something that's hard to value, buy some art, and then you can argue with the tax man as to how much it's worth, maybe leave the UK. But all those three things mean there's less investment in the economy, and that is bad for growth, it's bad for jobs.
Can I give a little bit of pushback here? Because I think someone like a Gary Stevenson, a Dale Vince, you know, two of these guys who signed up to this Patriotic Millionaires Pact, which is this idea of, you know, we have a load of money and we believe that we should be taxed more. And Gary Stevenson will always say tax assets, not income, right? Tax the things that people own.
What kind of wealth tax would you introduce and where would the limit start?
So I want to be clear, when I'm talking about taxing the rich, it's not about income, it's not about work, it's not about bankers, lawyers, assets. God forbid, even YouTubers or TV presenters. It's about assets.
Yeah.
We talk about assets over 10 million, but really the problem is billionaires, people with assets of over 100 million, we say 2% over 10 million pounds, just on what you have above that.
That to me seems like a pretty fair, like, moral argument, because what we've seen over the last 50 years is that assets have become increasingly stripped away from working class people, and more of that ownership has gone into the top level of society, right? Like the top 1% own half of global wealth.
I'm not an expert in inequality. I'm not going to contest those stats. But when we talk about taxing assets, there's some assets where taxing them is a great idea. What's the asset that we can tax and there won't be less of it? Land.
Right.
If you tax land, you guarantee there isn't less of it. In fact, if you tax it the right way, there'll be more of it because people have an incentive to develop it. We could talk later about ways of taxing land that are both fairer and more economically efficient and pro-growth. Wealth tax, you're taxing investment.
Right.
So if you do that, you are going to mean there is less investment by people in the UK. There's going to be less investment people outside the UK, because why are they going to put money in the UK and be subject to the wealth tax? They could put the money somewhere else. The top 1% pay about 30% of all income tax. It's a tax that's very sensitive to a few people, which is makes it a bit fragile, a bit dangerous. That's nothing to the wealth tax. The wealth tax collects 80% of its funds from just 5,000 people, and it would collect £4 billion from just 10 people. Now, that is mega fragile.
Right.
And
because one of those people could just leave.
A lot of people think leaving is like a big thing. Someone's living in the UK, they're going to now take their family, take their job, they're going to move and go somewhere else. It's not really like that. If you are worth £5 million, that's what it is. But if you're worth £100 million or £1 billion, you don't spend all your time in the UK. You probably have three or four houses in different countries in the world. You spend a few months a year in the UK, a few months a year in New York, a few months in Paris, whatever. So ceasing to be UK tax resident, it's just a diary change. You're spending a couple of weeks less here. It's super easy. And if there are hundreds of millions of pounds riding on that, you're going to change your diary. So building a tax which depends upon where you are £4 billion depending on 10 people not changing their diary is really dumb.
I don't know if you saw, there was an infographic going around last week that had like, it was like a list of millionaires that have gone to countries or left countries. And you've got this one red bar at the bottom of this massive, massive loss of, was it like 10,000 millionaires? Mm-hmm. And it's the UK.
Oh, this is the New World Wealth Stats. Yeah. I mean, though, quite often, I and Tax Policy Associates make ourselves really unpopular for saying things that everyone fucking hates. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yes, of course. Go fucking mental, mate.
So these are some reports put out by a firm called Henley & Partners, which is in the business of selling relocation. Yeah, remember that.
Yeah, they're wealth managers, basically, right?
They're not just wealth managers. They're in the specific business of selling relocation. So they do not manage your wealth in the UK staying here. They're only interested in you if you're moving from one place to another. So remember that.
Sounds like a bit of a conflict of interest, Dan.
Why would they release statistics like that? The amazing Tim Harford, he got to the bottom. The guy, there was one guy in South Africa who puts these figures together just by randomly sampling LinkedIn. No statistical controls at all. So these figures that are everywhere, all over the press, showing millionaires leaving the UK, they are just crap.
They're bogus.
Their figures show that something like under 1% of UK millionaires are leaving. Those figures are too low. Actually, probably something like 5%, 10% of the mega wealthy are leaving the UK. So these figures are bogus and they're too low. So now everyone can hate me. But here's the other thing. When the government made its non-dom changes, they were on the basis that a quarter of the mega wealthy would leave. So the figures are bogus. They're too low. We actually expect more to leave, and that won't be a problem for the government's for the government's plan. So now everyone dislikes me.
Where are these people going? If you're saying they're leaving, on the grounds are they leaving? I mean,
so these are non-doms. We should different from the wealth tax debate. They're different people and it has a different effect. So if you're non-dom, it means that you're born abroad and your permanent home is abroad. You can also leave the UK and leave all your assets here. If you own a big British business and you leave the UK, you're no longer taxed from that business. So it's kind of, it's not that economically damaging a thing to do. If you want to escape the wealth tax, you have to completely leave.
Assets and all.
If you're a billionaire, you're probably quite international assets. But if you're merely somewhat wealthy, like, say, a mere 100 million, you may well have a big UK private business. You'll need to get rid of that if you want to escape the wealth tax. So the wealth tax is more economically damaging.
But what if people couldn't leave? Like, let's say that there was a tax that was put on them whilst they tried to leave.
Yeah, sure. Like exit tax. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So an exit tax for capital gains is a pretty good idea if you're careful. So
get in there.
Well, why is that? Let's imagine that Jovan founds a company and after 10 years, it's worth 50 million quid and you strike a deal with private equity to sell it. You strike a deal with private equity to sell it 50 million quid. You will pay tax on that of about 12 million quid, which I think is a pretty sweet deal, but you might not like that. What's the thing you can do to absolutely guarantee you won't pay tax on the 50 million quid? Leave. Go to Monaco, which is a shithole. Stay out the UK for 5 years. You've just escaped tax.
Do now, the Lewis Hamilton.
Do the Lewis Hamilton's a bit different because he, in a way, he didn't have an asset. He has like a constant stream of income. So exit tax wouldn't stop him. But for evil Jovan,
capitalist
Jovan.
Capitalist Jovan. Yet.
You ain't made 50 mil yet. I want to see some of that money as well.
You spent 10 years building up this asset in the UK and yet you leave and pay no tax. That feels unjust. There's kind of an opposite case. Imagine French Freddy, who spent 10 years in France building up a 50 million business.
Bien sûr.
moves to the... With the moustache.
Allons-y, allons-y.
Could be French. You've built up a 50 million euro business. You come to the UK. After 5 minutes in the UK, you sell the business. The UK taxes all of that gain. We've got no fucking business taxing that gain. So rationally, we could fix both things. We could say we're only going to tax the gain you make in the UK. Yeah. So French Freddy doesn't get taxed.
Right.
But
which incentivizes French Freddy to move over to the UK. 100%.
Yeah. And France is a bad example because there's high tax anyway, but it stops people coming here from lower tax countries. And we shouldn't be doing that. So make that change. But also tax capitalist Jovan, who we should be taxing that gain. Now, it's easy to say. It's quite hard to do. Because if I say, we are going to have an exit tax next Wednesday, then Jovan is going to be out of here by Tuesday. Worse than that. If I now say I have an inside track with this government and there is going to be an exit tax in the budget, and people were stupid enough to believe me, it's not true, then Jovan would also leave. So exit taxes are really dangerous. Jovan, who decided to stay here, was happy to pay capital gains tax on his 50 million, isn't happy with the wealth tax. Well, he's going to leave and pay the exit tax. So an exit tax that stops wealth tax exits has to be much harsher. Right. Not a tax on gain, but something like sort of a 30% tax on all your wealth. And that is huge. The mere rumour that might happen is going to make people run off, not just people who are rich today, people who think they'll be rich in the future, people who aspire to be rich, and no one wealthy is going to come here if they're going to be trapped. But the problem with these new style wealth taxes is they're very hard to avoid, which is deliberate, unless you leave. We don't want people to leave. Spoiler alert, this is a capitalist society and the wealthy own capital and capital is what makes the economy happen. If you don't like that, cool. You know, go out there.
Whisper that to some of our leftist audience. It's going to be very upsetting to hear.
You can aspire to change that. Nothing wrong with that. You can be a trot if you like. Great. What you can't do is say that you believe in economic growth. You're not trying to throw capitalists into the gulag. You're broadly happy with how things are, but you want a wealth tax and you don't care about capital leaving. No, you can't say all those things. They're contradictory. Yeah. You do care about capital leaving. So the question for proponents of a wealth tax is, what is the GDP impact of what you're proposing? And you often hear this populist line from them, which is like, 2%, it's a tiny tax. Yeah, it's a tiny tax. Why is anyone going to care about 2%? And it's true. If you raise my income tax by 2%, I would not give a toss. Wealth is different. How much tax do I pay if I receive a dividend? If I'm a top earner, I pay 39.35% tax on my dividend. Imagine that I'm also paying a wealth tax. So I have 100 quid of investments. I get a return on the investments of, say, 5. So out of the 5 that I just received on my investment, I'm paying 2 in wealth tax and 2 or 3 in tax. That's a big slice.
So you're not making any money then?
You're not making any money. So the wealth tax has this weird feature that if someone is making a massive return, say you're a private equity guy making 20% return off your assets, 2% is pretty small. But if you're someone who's made some long-term investment in the UK, you're getting like a 4 or 5% return or even an 8% return. The wealth tax is massive. If you're getting an 8% return, 2% is a quarter of that. It's equivalent to a confiscation of a quarter of your wealth. An asset you had that was worth 100 million is now worth like 75 million. So 2% on your assets isn't small. It's massive. And people who say it's tiny are not really thinking clearly, and it's really alarming. There's been wealth taxes for 140 years. And these wealth taxes tended to apply not just to the mega wealthy, but to everyone. They had a lower rate and they had vast exemptions. They tended to exempt most private businesses. And they did that to avoid the economic damage we're talking about. So they raised not very much. The French had a wealth tax for 60 years. Evidence is that that was not damaging to French growth. Why wasn't it damaging to French growth? Because it was so fucking easy to avoid.
No one was paying it.
No one was. Actually, the middle class were paying it, and that's how these taxes tend to end up. But the very wealthy...
Because again, that's their income that's actually being taxed.
Well, it's because if your wealth is your home and a bit of savings, and you're taxed on that, there's nothing you can do to get out of that. You're just there. But if you're the mega wealthy, well, you put your listed shares into a private company, job done. What you can't then do and say, the French wealth tax proves there's no economic harm from a wealth tax. No, the French wealth tax proves there's no economic harm from a shit wealth tax.
One of the wealth taxes I've read about recently is in Spain. How has that gone for them?
Tax Justice Network put out something saying we can, the world should copy the Spanish wealth tax. We would raise $2 trillion globally. Like, wow. How much does a Spanish wealth tax collect? 600 million euros. It's like nothing. Why is that? How can you tax the wealthy and raise so little? And the answer is because it contains really generous exemptions, which mean that in particular, private businesses, privately owned businesses, which is where a lot of wealth is, are basically untaxed. How could the government have been such idiots? So were they captured by the neoliberals? Were they heavily lobbied? No, this was a socialist stroke communist coalition that put in this wealth tax. They knew exactly what they were doing. They wanted a wealth tax because, let's be mean, because it felt good. It felt suitably socialist. But they also didn't want to fuck up the economy. And so they did something which they can say is a wealth tax, but isn't really truly taxing wealth. Now, I think politicians should not do things that feel good, have kind of very little effect, but are slightly harmful. I don't think politicians should do that. That's what the Spanish did. We should not copy that. We should maybe learn and say, if a Spanish socialist stroke communist coalition thought a big wealth tax was economically damaging, then maybe we should think that too.
Doesn't that just look good to the electorate? I mean, when they're really on the long list.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, I mean, and so I wonder, on a political point, purely political point, isn't that good comms? I mean, we've done something. Before the next election, they can say, well, we've implemented a wealth tax and we've raised such a significant amount of revenue to the ordinary person. For me, £600 million is incomprehensibly large.
But I know, and I think you know, it's at a price. Yes, it's good comms, but what's good comms brought us in tax? Good comms has brought us years of litigation over Jaffa cakes and a VAT system that really subsidises the wealthy. Yeah, good comms has brought us a council tax system that means that a penthouse in Mayfair pays less council tax than a terraced house in Stoke. Great comms, those changes. They were brilliant. Good comms brought us child benefit clawback that means that someone earning 60 grand can pay an effective rate of tax when you take into account child benefit clawback and student loan of 70% or more. These were great comms, politically really successful. Substantive terms, disasters. So I have zero tolerance for politically nice, politically attractive focus groups, wells, gesture politics. And in the long term, it does not produce good comms. Yeah, ask a graduate with young children paying a 70% marginal tax rate. Ask how good they feel about the tax they're paying. So these are traps the left should not be going down. God, there was a, I'm not sure when this is going out, but there was an editorial in The Guardian yesterday that said the government should be doing more economic populism. Look up populism in the fucking dictionary. You don't want to be doing populism.
It might be responsible for how we've got into this mess.
Something which is good on the surface and attractive on the surface and polls well in a 3-second conversation is not something you want to do. 1992. Labour's election, the shadow budget, lots of fanfare, fantastic musical backdrop, all looked really swish, announcing there would be an increase of 10p tax on high earners, an increase in national insurance on high earners. And it polled really well, at focus group really, really well. The Tories, of course, didn't sit back. They attacked it as Labour's tax bombshell. They portrayed it as an attack on aspiration, and people agreed. And lots of postmortems of the 92 election say that that shadow budget was significantly responsible for Labour's loss. Certainly Philip Gould, who led Labour's polling effort, absolutely believes it. So this populism, I mean, it's the thing I care about, whether it's a good idea, it ain't, but also the idea that it's going to be politically popular once it enters the sort of front line of politics. Often it isn't.
Let's try and figure out a solution, right? So let's say there is this issue around, capital flight. There's an issue around people being able to hide money and using all these different smart sort of schemes. What if there was a global agreement that said, let's actually tax the top 0.1%, and we made sure that it was internationally enforced? That would probably require actually like to end tax havens, which you might think is an impossibility, but I don't really see what the moral argument is for allowing tax havens to exist.
And there has been efforts to try and do something of that, I'm sure, recently.
We should return to that because it's really fascinating. But talk about the international globally coordinated wealth tax. So that you wouldn't have capital flight because there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
You'd still have people spending rather than saving. You couldn't do anything about that. So you'd still have a bit of a hit, but you would have less of a hit. Why not do it? Okay. What are the countries with the biggest number of billionaires?
America,
China, India, Russia. Germany, Russia. The US, who thinks the US is having a wealth tax? Come on. China, not having a wealth tax. India, not having a wealth tax. Germany did years ago. Its constitutional court said it's unconstitutional. Russia, not having a wealth tax. So the five countries with the biggest number of billionaires aren't having a wealth tax. What are the odds of a globally coordinated wealth tax?
Well, pretty low.
Exactly.
But I can see, and I know you said earlier, you're not a professor of inequality, but I think inequality is becoming a bigger and bigger running sore, not just in democratic societies. It's always been an issue in Russian societies about the oligarchy controlling politics.
And China.
And China as well.
China, yeah, massive increase in wealth, an amazing reduction in poverty. The price has been inequality. Are they better off with a billion fewer peasants and a million more millionaires? Yeah, I would say clearly they are. Is it a problem? I'll leave that to specialists in inequality to talk about.
That was going to go to my next question. I mean, I live in South London and I see the inequality just rising more and more and disparities just endlessly growing. What do you say to those people who are working so hard and who see a concentration of wealth at the top whilst there is an increasing concentration of poverty? If not a wealth tax, what does some form of sustainable revenue for the Treasury look like?
If you look at how the UK has always raised tax, how other countries raise tax, the vast majority, about 70%, comes from income tax, national insurance, VAT, and then corporation tax, smaller but still significant. If you want to raise tax, serious amounts of tax, you kind of need to go there. And in the UK, the median worker pays less tax on their income than almost any other large economy, with the exception of the US. People don't feel that. I think a lot of that's because of the deterioration of public services.
Right.
But we actually, as the median worker, doesn't pay much tax in the UK in comparison with other places.
I'm just thinking, and I hate to quote Thatcher, but when she said the problem with socialism is you run out of other people's money. So you're basically implying that social democracy is almost too expensive to operate as it stands today?
Well, absolutely not. Because if you go to Denmark, Sweden, Belgium, you see successful social democracies with expansive public services, quid pro quo, very high levels of tax. France, so extremely high levels of tax, median earner paying ultimately something like 50% in tax. Here it's more like sort of 30%. So massively more tax, better public services. France, they seem to have crossed the Rubicon and it's becoming a bit unsustainable. But Germany, it seems a sustainable outcome. And it's a level of tax people are comfortable with because they perceive they're getting something back. So for me, that is a absolutely social democracy is possible. It's also possible. So a successful lower tax state. You could imagine a UK with significantly lower levels of tax, less public services, means-tested pension, insurance-based NHS. People watching this may not want that.
Makes me feel sick.
But it could be a workable route. Yeah, there's workable routes both ways. Problem is,
we're in the middle.
When did you last hear a politician advocating that most people should pay a bit more tax?
Well, that would kill you off from getting re-elected, wouldn't it?
That's kind of creating a problem because over time the population ages, and so state spending necessarily becomes higher in certain areas, social care, health spending, which we protect, meaning everything else gets real terms cuts, becomes worse. And that happened under the Tories. It's happening under Labour. And we can play around with the tax system here and there. Yeah, there's lots of ways to do it. We can talk about it. You raise $1 billion here, $1 billion there. You can't raise $24 billion costlessly. There's some things you could do right now.
Land taxes.
And spoiler. and they would make things better. And we should be talking about them, stuff that we can do and stuff that would work, and something where the downside is actually an upside, rather than talk about a wealth tax where it's just utopian fantasy, never going to happen. We're going to lie to ourselves by pretending there's no downside. Unlike everything else we see in the world, we pretend it's a free lunch. It's not just a pointless conversation, it's a dangerous conversation. And people on the left shouldn't get caught into the trap of utopianism.
So, Dan, what are these things that the government can and should be doing right now to make our tax system more amenable, better functioning, and raising revenue?
So sometimes you can't do all of those things. Sometimes you can just do some of those things. National insurance. If you are an employee, you pay income tax on your income. You also pay national insurance. There is no difference. National insurance is a tax. A lot of people think national insurance is like a little pot, and the national insurance I pay is going into some virtual box and government is going to fund my pension. It's never worked like that. It's just tax. And that myth has been rather happy for governments over the years because they've been able to increase employee national insurance and more recently employer national insurance and not get the political pain if they raised income tax. The comms have been good. What does that mean though? If you are working, you pay 8% employee national insurance. If you are a landlord, you don't. If you're retired, you don't. No matter how much you're earning, if you're retired, you don't pay national insurance on your income. This is wrong. What we could do and should do is abolish employee national insurance entirely. And to his credit, Jeremy Hunt was kind of going in that direction. You abolish employee national insurance, you roll it into income tax. So now you, instead of paying 8% national insurance, you pay nothing. And instead of paying 20% income tax, you pay, probably works out at about 25, 26%. So if you are earning, this is a tax cut. If you're retired, it's a tax increase.
But we know you can't do that, well, not with pensioners.
I was going to say, but the Treasury is basically raising more money from tax cuts of ordinary working people and then displacing some of that to people who are no longer working because they've retired.
And landlords and people receiving interest. And I think that's how you politically sell it. You say, we are not raising money from this. This is not a tax increase. Overall, every pound of increase is going out in tax cuts. And I assume that you would lose some votes from retired people. And I don't know how many votes Labour has there to lose.
They're pretty sunk right now, yeah.
But that, I would also hope, is a vote winner among the people who are out there working and paying tax. And here's the funny thing. You know who else would agree with this? The Adam Smith Institute would agree with this. The Institute of Economic Affairs would agree with this. Pretty much every tax policy wonk, left to right, would agree this is the right thing to do.
So now we've got 16 and 17-year-olds voting. Is this a way in which they can gently accommodate and start to address a kind of increasing geritocracy where people basically are in receipt of a welfare state that young people won't able to probably ever get access to in their lifetimes. Will this solve some of the generational inequalities that we're seeing?
I'm going to be really boring and not answer that question. So I am an expert in tax. I am not an expert in inequality. I am not an expert in politics. What do I know about 16-year-olds? So I don't know. I would like to think it would. I would like to think you're right, but I don't know. Yeah. I know it's the right thing to do.
But we can posit that it probably will. Correct. I mean, like,
I would hope.
Yeah, it's 1.5 million new voters that are going to come into the system.
Probably, new voters or new potentially able to vote, maybe as
potentially a vote, exactly. And might not turn out as well. If you go on based on previous issues with young people voting,
may not be Labour voters at that as well.
Well, maybe pro-populist voters, pensioners in particular. They get the red carpet rolled out for them because they do vote. Like, they actually do turn out. We couldn't take away winter fuel payments and make them means tested without it causing absolute havoc electorally, and now we backtracked.
But here's the problem. If you want to do anything about inequality, and if you want to rephase the tax system so that people who currently have fewer assets pay less tax, or then you also have to make it so with more assets pay more tax. And that's disproportionately the old, the boomers. So if you're saying we can't touch the boomers, then we should end this interview right now because there's nothing to be done.
Okay. Mm. See you later. Well, okay, but this is interesting, right? Because
I'm still available on BBC Sounds, so I should point out. Untaxing on BBC Sounds. I'm gonna do this anyway. We normally it's really hard to talk about tax policy in the mainstream. Everyone wants to talk about a penny on income tax or evil tax avoiding corporations. No one wants to talk about hard tax policy. We were gifted a series, only 5 episodes of 20 minutes each on BBC Radio 4, Untaxing. It is available on BBC Sounds. Duly plugged.
Plugged comfortably. Okay.
And so organic and smooth. No one saw it coming.
But back to the point of what we were saying around the pensioners, though, land value tax, that's going to affect pensioners as well, right? Because that generation have had this asset be massively inflated over the course of their life, whilst the demand has risen, supply has not. So that again is going to be a challenge for any government to do, because it's going to potentially lose them some votes. But it seems, again, eminently sensible.
Should we talk about land value tax? So land value tax is the idea that right now we have 3 taxes on property, and they are just about our 3 worst taxes. So council tax broken because it is so deeply regressive. And it's not a surprise it's regressive, because it was put together on a wet Wednesday in the panic after the poll tax riots.
Violence broke out in London during a protest against a new council tax called the poll tax. Many protesters said the march was hijacked by violent anarchists who attacked the police. Ultimately, the hugely unpopular tax was binned, and it also played a part in ending Margaret Thatcher's time as Prime Minister.
It was a temporary clutch.
I mean, we still have the same
brackets. It was great comms, though.
Don't we still have the same brackets since, like, 1991 or something?
Yeah, there hasn't been revalued since 1991. We'll be living on Mars in the year 3000, valuing our bubble on 1991 valuations. That's council tax. Bonkers. Business rates. Why? Because if we revalued, some people would win and some people would lose. The people who lose would be angry, and politicians can't deal with that. Business rates are broken. We see that when we see the high streets, because if you had a high street shop, which was very valuable 4 years ago, and today the high street's decimated, you'd hardly rent it out for anything, business rates will often still work on the value 4 years ago. So it's really hard for anyone to rent it out. Stamp duty, broken. You've somehow made it into a house worth 300 grand. You have the opportunity to move to a better job, other side of the country, other side of London. You want to buy another house worth 300 grand, but of course you can't, because stamp duty,
it's insane,
is an additional block. There was a report, I think 25 years ago now, stamp duty gums up the labour market. Stamp duty is 5 times higher than it was 25 years ago.
Wow.
So
that's your thing about incentives, right? You're creating a disincentive to move.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. You tax people moving, you're stopping people moving. Why do we want to stop people moving? Mad. So what do you do instead? So land value tax is about 150 years old in its basic conception. It's supported by economists from, again, the Adam Smith Institute to the Resolution Foundation. The idea is you tax land every year. You don't tax the value of the building, you tax the unimproved value of the land. So if you have some land which you're not doing much with and you could be building houses there, you get taxed as if it was valuable, because it is valuable, you're just not using it. And that incentivizes you to use it. And if you already own land, currently business rates and, to a degree, council tax gives you an incentive not to improve it because you'd be paying more tax. Land value tax gives you an incentive to improve it because then land value tax, the proportion of property value, goes down. So in principle, brilliant. But it's hard because a lot of people do not want to pay an annual tax on their property, particularly people who've lucked out and are living in very large properties that they couldn't actually afford to buy today.
So would they have to sell it then if that was something you introduced?
Well, at this point, I get a bit free market because what's the word for someone who is asset rich but cash poor? The word is rich. Yeah, if you live in a £3 million house, you have £3 million. How can you get £3 million? You could borrow. You could sell and move somewhere else. You could rent out part of the house. There's lots of ways to do it. But ultimately, it's in society's interest that we free up property. If you don't, you can build houses, and we should have a tax system that encourages that. But if you want it to be easier for young people to afford homes, it has to be harder for some other people. Again, there's no free lunch. We can't magic houses out of nowhere.
Well, clearly, we're trying to build them, but we can't build them quick enough.
No, you can't. So there's always going to be a political cost. Yeah, there's always an opportunity cost. There's always a trade-off. And the politicians have to accept that. And they haven't been willing to do that. Land value tax, supported by economists across the political spectrum, supported by not a single politician. The Green Party used to be in favour of the land value tax. Last election, they dropped that. Became a long-term aspiration. Instead, stupid utopian wealth taxes. The most depressing tax development for me are the people who had no hope of being in government. The only thing they can do is move the political dynamic. What's the terrible phrase? Move the Overton window. They didn't. They decided just to play populist politics. Pathetic.
I mean, we're seeing people like Mr. Dyson buy up hordes of land in this country, yeah, basically to
avoid inheritance,
yeah, consolidate his wealth that way. There's complete wastage, effectively, of the land. It's private. There's no commons aspect to it. I mean, ordinary people can't access the land. It's not being turned into anything that is socially useful.
Well, I think part of that is planning, that if the land couldn't have houses built on it, no matter who owns it, then tax isn't going to make a change. You need to make planning law easier. You need to deregulate. Labour, to its great credit, probably the best thing the government has done is a bit of planning deregulation. You need to go further. Not by area. I'm not going to say more about it than that. But once you've done that, if the land has development potential, then a land value tax provides a huge incentive on someone like Dyson to either develop it or sell it. And either of those is a good result. The question is, how do you square the circle? How do you transition to land value tax in a way which is fair, which doesn't kick grandma out of her house, and is politically doable? And I think there are ways. You just need to think about doing it in the long term, say phasing it in over 10 years, gradually mutating council tax and business rates into a land value tax, and at the same time cutting stamp duty. Again, we can't do utopian thinking. There is no point me drawing on a blank sheet of paper the perfect land value system, let's do it today, because it's not going to happen. You have to have a way to move towards it, and it can be done, I'm convinced.
And then just on the land thing, because this is obviously a conversation that's come up a lot in the last couple of months with Labour's family tax on farms and things around that kind of stuff. If you've got a farm, for example, and now you're being slapped with what is seen to be an unjust levels of inheritance tax for young farmers, is it hysteria? Is it sensationalist? Has the Chancellor made the right decision?
There was a huge amount of use of agricultural land for tax avoidance.
Dyson, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost certainly Dyson. What Labour did is probably going to affect very few farm estates, probably just a few hundred a year. And a lot of farmers are very unhappy when I said that, but I nevertheless believe that it's true. Mostly it's easy to avoid. You can give it to your children 7 years but before you die. Some people can't do that. Some farmers are too old. They're not going to live 7 years. Some can't afford to give it away. Some don't have children. So these aren't don't always work. So some people will pay, and lots more, even those who almost certainly won't pay it, worry about it. So it has a consequence. What Labour did went too far in hurting family farms, but not enough to stop tax avoidance. Because if today I have 5 million quid, I want to buy agricultural land to avoid tax, that still works. The first million quid is totally inheritance tax free. The next 4 million quid is 50% free of inheritance tax, so 20% effective rate. So Labour went too far and not far enough at the same time. There's a better way. What's the better way? One thing you could do is you could say, okay, we will continue to have a complete inheritance tax exemption for farms. Not the biggest, say, I don't know, 10 million, 20 million you guys have to pay. You are very asset rich. You can monetize that. Smaller farms, you're going to be completely exempt from inheritance tax. But if your children sell the farm or stop using it as farmland, bang, we reverse that exemption.
So then you protect the family farm.
Yeah, and it's quite right. If someone inherits a family farm, sells it and gets cash, they should be taxed in the same way as someone who inherits cash, because they did inherit cash. We propose in a bit of detail how it could work, and the National Farmers Union supports the idea. Small farmers support the idea.
National farmers must be annoyed that there are super rich people who are now complicating this picture for them by trying to do some smart little tax avoidance.
Many, many farmers are. For the NFU, its members include those guys, so it's harder for the NFU. It's kind of really weird that there are farmers who own land, which is worth millions and millions of pounds, but they are scraping and saving to make a penny. From an economist's point of view, that is impossible. You cannot have an asset worth 5 million quid that only yields 100,000 pounds a year. That shouldn't be. But it is. Why? Because people are buying land for other reasons. One of those reasons is to avoid tax, and you can stop that. You can actually help farmers by reducing the value of their assets, which is a very unusual thing, but you can. The other reason is people buy agricultural land just because it's nice. You're buying a big house in the country, great. Maybe you buy 30 acres of farmland to go with it. Oh, that's lovely. That means that the value of farmland gets artificially elevated. And again, the answer to that, let's go back to it, land value tax.
As you've pointed out, there is an orthodox view across tax experts, across the political tax spectrum, about just some things that would make this system simpler and better functioning. And yet we don't do them.
The Treasury knows it. HMRC knows it. The politicians know it.
Everyone knows it, but then we don't do it.
But they won't do it. And it's not because politicians are stupid. It's not because they're dishonest, that they are terrified of the public. They don't want to say the truth. And the truth is that the current direction is unsustainable. Every year, we have more and more elderly people who have to be paid for. And that means that we either cut the NHS, which we can't do, so we cut other stuff, and taxes go up. And that's the path we're on. And unless you make a change, you're not choosing the status quo. You're choosing a status quo that is getting worse and worse every year.
And this is a massive problem, though, because people feel as if like democracy itself is not responsive to their needs, right? Like people vote in a government, they expect them to do something. We came on a massive...
But it's worse. Democracy change. Is responding. It is responding to people saying...
It's responding to the wrong incentives,
I don't want to pay more tax. I want to continue to live in a £2 million house and not pay any tax on that every year. Democracy is responding to the people who vote, and politicians are terrified of upsetting those people.
I think back to the election, and Paul Johnson, who's now just left the Institute of Fiscal Studies, was making a big song and dance saying that essentially the major parties are lying to you about the state of the public finances. They're all that no one's talking about rising taxes, even though that's inevitable.
Yeah.
And now guess what? It seems we're a few months out now from the next budget, but it seems pretty inevitable that taxes are going to rise. Do you think now is the moment for the government to finally be bold? And how likely do you think that is?
I thought the last government had a brilliant moment to be bold. So Jeremy Hunt, within the constraints he was under, I think was a good chancellor. He made some small but good changes. He could have said, we are abolishing employee national insurance. We're rolling it into income tax. Would the Tories have done worse at the general election? Maybe. If you think that they are in a political hole, maybe now is the time to bet big and do some bold tax reform. You can do tax reform which is supported by wonks across the political spectrum, business-friendly, pro-growth tax reform. And if Labour MPs started clamouring for that and thinking about radical pro-growth tax reform, we would be in so much of a more positive environment than utopian meanderings about wealth taxes.
We came in on a ticket that said specifically growth, wealth creation,
You know,
and no tax rises.
And we've been boxed in, I think, by that. What makes me a bit despondent about politics, having worked briefly in it, is that there are things that are known to be sensible to do that just are, for whatever reason, politically impossible. And then you end up presiding over a system that seems to be in decline. And it's quite obviously that the case, you know, it doesn't matter which voter you speak to, from whatever kind of angle and perspective they're looking at, they feel as if the country is moving backwards, not forwards. And then you get stuff like this uni-party narrative, right? That is not a difference between Tories and Labour, because it's the same managed decline. I think within that context, all I can kind of point to is to now actually say, maybe we should do something radical. It doesn't have to be populist. But it has to be different, right? You have to rip up the rule book to a certain degree and be quite forthright about it.
I have an interesting chat. Sorry.
No. And whilst I agree with that, I also think there's something around the spiraling levels of inequality where the optics, and we've spoken about the kind of realities of wealth taxes and things like that, but the more there is a greater level of disparity, the more the kind of sentiment's going to be that we have to pursue a wealth tax, which isn't going to create the revenue that we once believed it could do. And politicians may go down on the left, on the right, whatever, may go down cheap and quite hollow responses to increasing grievances and disaffection that doesn't get the country out of any form of doom loop that we're in.
It pushes us further into it. Exactly. Yeah. Because you're promising stuff that won't work or can't be achieved. Again, like the Spanish wealth tax, it's just taking you further down the spiral. I had an interesting chat the other day with a bunch of extremely wealthy people, non-doms, talking about their reasons for thinking of leaving the UK. Now, tax was one of them, yeah. But the others are interesting. They were very worried about crime. The idea that they weren't safe walking to their homes in Mayfair or Belgravia or wherever, and they weren't safe walking the streets. They were worried about immigration. They found it very difficult to bring their family into the UK.
Immigration from the perspective of like being able to come in, not about...
Not about mass migration. They don't care about that. Yeah. No, the difficulty bringing their family into the UK. People who in no sense would be a drain on the state, but they couldn't bring them in. More than that, they had a sense that Britain was in decline. And that was what they worried about the most. So, funnily enough, tax, immigration, crime, decline, not so different from the concerns of everybody.
But that's also what's also interesting is that you've spoken about, you know, better functioning tax systems in Europe, which have like a more progressive or higher rate. But even in those countries, you're seeing the same, you know, questions pop up.
Because you've got the same demographic challenge, which pushes everything.
But you've also got the same political economy challenge as well, right? Which is that essentially all of these developed economies are hooked on debt. And that's a big thing as well. In America, you can argue that part of what the ascendancy of Trump and all of the billionaire class kind of crowding in behind him was someone that said, ultimately, I'm going to protect your wealth. And I think that takes us back to the original inequality problem that Jovan and I are still trying to... This is to square within this circle hole, which is that, are you working within a system with rules which are clearly set in place, which I think is often how you're kind of figuring out, you know, what tax stuff can be done based on what the orthodoxy and conventions are of this time? Or do we have to actually zoom out and think even bigger picture about the way in which our political economies are set up? Are we at an inflection point where we need to go back to, you know, the drawing board actually about political theory to create societies that function better? Yeah. Because
way above my pay scale.
You understand where I'm coming from here? Because it does feel like this slide to authoritarianism, which is kind of broadly being spoken about across the political spectrum, you know.
Is a response to institutions basically failing and breaking down as we see them. And there doesn't seem to be a coherent response on almost anything, on the arrangements of the economy, on kind of social issues, on cultural issues, on some of the biggest political questions of the day. This doom loop that
I'm despondent about the tax doom loop. You're telling me there's an everything doom loop?
I think there is a bit of
I'm going to stick to tax because it's the only thing I know about. Okay. It's the only thing I'm even slightly able to influence, and the emphasis on slightly.
Well, we're throwing this to our audience mainly, to be honest, to get them to think about, because it's not just tax people we want to speak to. We want to speak to people across the political spectrum, but we are finding the same, like we spoke to a disinformation expert and he's going, this is really bad for democracy because people are essentially talking past each other with alternative facts. We've spoken to, you know, other political advisors who are essentially saying, yeah, like we know that there are things that can be done but won't be done. And the system itself seems to be just preserving itself, but at the cost of being...
Let's focus on land, because for me, the one thing which creates the most burning sense of unfairness in, God, I sound old now, in young people I speak to, is, God, I'm like that Steve Buscemi meme. That's awful.
With the backwards
cat. Yeah. Hey, kids. It's land that, and you have it on every level. That I know teachers who cannot afford to live anywhere near central London. Forget teachers. I speak to investment bankers who can't afford to live in central London. A razor focus from politicians on property is the thing. And again, we've had populism. We've had making it, giving people more money, to put into property. So we had the sort of Help to Buy scheme. We had the special ISA for houses. We've had stamp duty cuts. But that's a disaster, because if you put more money into a system where the limiting factor is not enough houses, prices go up. Congratulations. You slightly change who the winners and losers are, but you're not changing the game. You have to change the game. And that means planning, not my area, but I know it's fucked up. And it means tax.
Yeah, it's a supply problem, right?
It's a supply problem.
We've got to increase supply. Maybe it is a housing theory of everything, you know. Maybe that is the way the government should try and, you know, reassess its priorities and its comms mission, is to say people are worried about having secure living arrangements in the future. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure that there's more houses. And it's not just about cutting planning regulation. Yeah. It's about sorting tax. It's about getting new builders. It's about skills training.
Yeah.
You know, it's all
the housing theory of quite a lot, if not the housing theory of everything. But what are we hearing instead? The other day, to talk about changing mortgage conditions, making it easier for people to borrow more money. You're doing it again. You're putting more money in.
But that's clearly the lever that they feel that they can actually pull, as opposed to these other ones, because of all of these.
Because there's no downside.
Yeah. Yeah. There's less of a, I guess this is less of an obvious downside to the normal voter, because they might not understand conceptually why that thing doesn't work.
But your point, Freddie, all levers. I was talking the other day to somebody who runs a building firm. The difficulty he was having hiring brickers, finding brickers these days is really hard.
Because of immigration as well.
Immigration part of it, yeah. What can we do? What can we do to make sure there is more availability of builders, more availability of building materials, easier planning, easier legal conveyancing of real estate? Look at every level there and say, what can we do everywhere?
The essence of my politics, which is just restoring dignity at the heart of it, because once you can dignify someone with a level of stability that is affordable, that they can maximize and realize their own aspirations, then things then seem to then flourish. I mean, it's a question around bricklayers, it's a question around graduates, it's a question around stability, it's a question around housing, it's a question around health. And tax obviously is a kind of feeder into all of this stuff, but it's only an enabler to more effective redistribution, surely. Tax, it doesn't solve a fundamental crisis around redignifying people at the heart of their lives.
A home of your own is fundamental to that. I remember years ago hearing government shouldn't be enabling property ownership, because that would just increase contempt with capitalism, and that was a bad thing. I mean, Jesus Christ, could you be more detached from the reality of what people want?
People just want to have a house.
Everyone wants a house. Yeah, whether you're a refugee, whether you're living in a council house, whether you're living in a mansion, what you want is a home. And the current system is stopping that. So a razor-sharp focus on that. And tax is part of it, but I think not the biggest part.
It's skills training as well. It's like less people doing degrees and stuff that are struggling to find jobs at the end of it.
Yeah.
Brickies make good peas. Like, they make good money. And then they have, like, and it's...
Electricians can make six-figure incomes. Yeah.
I mean, loads of money.
Why don't we have a guild of electricians, or a Royal Institute for Plumbers, or some form of bricklaying institute? Yeah.
We should champion it more.
Yeah.
100%.
And property developer. I mean, it's fashionable in some places to kind of knock property developers, but we should be asking, why aren't there more small-scale property developers? Every planning regulation you create is easy for Wimpy Homes. They have a building full of people who do this shit. But for small-scale developers and builders, it's really, really hard. So we should be sweeping as much the shit away as we can.
I give you another big idea cell that I have. It's one of my more leftist takes, but I think we need to eliminate tax havens. I think that doesn't make any sense morally. It's not justifiable to me why they exist. I understand in, like, you know, Dubai, UAE has played the game perfectly. Singapore has played the game perfectly. They've got really well-functioning societies because they've got, you know, well, in the UAE's case, they've got access to hydrocarbons, access to slave labour, arguably.
Slave labour. Yeah. I'm going to depart from your definition.
But I think this is fascinating, right? Because what you've got in this country right now is cognitive dissonance between some people on the right who say, how dare these economic migrants come to my country in pursuit of a better life? And then they also say, well, all my mates are leaving to Dubai, and I completely understand why they're doing that, because they're going to pursue a better life where they have more money in their pocket. It creates the wrong sort of zero-sum game, I guess, globally, where tax systems have to keep on undercutting each other if they're going to be able to appeal to, you know, these mobile, talented young people who are meant to be driving economies forward. And we're seeing that now, right? We're seeing young brain drain of young people not just to places like,
I mean,
to the Middle East, but also to like Australia as well, because they'll get paid more money. And I just think that the tax haven problem is an obvious thing that the government could signal, which might be a little bit populisty, but like, let's get rid of the Isle of Man, being attached, and Jersey.
I think it's even more offensive that some of these tax havens exist within the British Isles. I mean, it's an insult to injury that just off the coast of the mainland of the UK, you can hoard your money off there. Does that not seem like an injustice given how close to home it is?
I feel like you know something that we don't about this.
Well, so tax havens are a bunch of different things. Okay, so one of those things is you can live there and pay no tax. And that's certainly true for the Isle of Man and Jersey. These days, it's very true of Dubai and more complicated ways, Singapore. You can't stop that. You're not going to be able to stop Dubai being Dubai. Unless we declare war on it, nothing we can do. And that's a problem for the UK because there is a, and I'd love to see some studies on this, there is definitely a brain drain to some degree of youngish professionals moving to Dubai to be accountants, lawyers, sometimes even coders, paying way lower levels of tax and receiving the same or more money. And that's a problem for the UK. Tax havens used to be something else. It used to be that evil Freddy this time.
Still with a moustache. Still moustache.
Can you twirl the moustache?
Definitely not.
you would take your winnings, you'd put them in a bank account in Jersey, not tell HMRC, and you would never be fucking caught. HMRC had no way to catch you unless someone blabbed. Then a few years ago, that started changing. And now there is a system called automatic exchange of information, where if evil Freddy opens a bank account in Jersey, that will be reported to HMRC. So you can no longer easily evade tax by sticking money offshore. Massive change. If you do that, you'll be caught. And if you put money offshore and declare it, you're taxed just as if it was with Barclays on Watford High Street. So that role of tax havens is over. Let's say I'm creating an investment fund or I'm creating a joint venture. Funds are not taxed because investors pay the tax when they get the money. Yeah, if I hold 100 Marks and Spencer's shares, I pay tax on those shares. If I invest in a fund that holds 100 Marks and Spencer's shares, the fund shouldn't be taxed. I should be taxed my return from the fund, which is the right result. Yeah. How do you do it with a UK fund? Easy. You pay a lot of people like me in my old life a lot of money, and we find a way to get the sensible result the fund isn't taxed. What if you really don't want to do that because you don't want to pay me lots of money? Or even worse, what if you're not trying to sell interest in a fund to people in the UK, but interest in a fund to people all over the world, and you could never make it work for all those countries? You set up the fund in a tax haven. And then easily, the fund pays no tax. The investors still pay tax on the end result. Anyone here who is a private pension fund, their pension fund is 100% invested in index trackers, private equity funds, hedge funds that are offshore and paying no tax. And that is correct and sensible and moral. Another bad of tax havens is that mostly they enable you to hide what's going on. And that can be used for tax avoidance. It can still with care be used for tax evasion. And it can be used for other reasons, for sanctions busting, for money laundering, for all kinds of criminality. Actually, the likes of Jersey, Isle of Man, Caymans, they're mentioning Isle of Man is a bit dodge. Jersey, Guernsey, Caymans, that is not their game. Their standards in this are probably higher than the UK's. But there are others where the standards are really fucking low. And Isle of Man, I'm afraid, their standards are pretty low. And there is bad stuff going on there. And we should be looking into ways to force transparency out of these places. Not, we don't need to change the tax rules, but if we have transparency, the tax will do what it's supposed to do. And there was a movement to do that. Unfortunately, then the European Court of Justice blocked transparency in the EU. And how can we say to the Isle of Man, you need to be fully transparent about who owns your companies, if the French and the Germans aren't fully transparent?
That sounds shocking to me. That sounds like something's going on there, right? Like, we have to also acknowledge that with the Panama Papers release, you know, there is a very low sense of trust in these places. I don't doubt that, of course, I take you at your word. I trust you deeply around there being good reasons for there to be tax havens, but there's plenty of bad ones which were exposed, and it compounds this sense, I think, upon some lay people, normal people, that essentially there are people with incredibly amounts of power loads of money who are essentially taking the piss out of the system, and they do it using these places where they hide.
Okay, but look at the stats on the tax gap. The tax gap is the difference between the tax that should be collected and the tax that is collected. Where do you think off the top of your head most of the tax gap is?
With super rich people.
Nope. So something like 5% of the tax gap is super rich and multinational corporations. Most of it, small business.
Trades.
Oh, really?
Cash in hand.
Here's the really weird thing. So I don't have an answer to this. I have a mystery. Over the last 20 years, the large business tax gap has fallen by 2/3. That's like an amazing achievement by, it has to be said, mostly a Conservative government, but also Labour gets some credit. Fallen by 2/3, fantastic. The small business tax gap has gone up 3 times. We're talking billions of pounds every year. And that, actually, you can't blame White Van Man for that, because sure, they're paid in cash, but they're not paid in cash today, 3 times more than they were 20 years ago. Mm. They're just not. And what I think it in fact is a systemic attacks on the tax system by extremely dodgy people running tax avoidance schemes that, in my view, are criminal. And again, on the Tax Policy Associates website, we've investigated quite a few of those. Yeah. And they're kind of getting away with it. And often tax havens are involved.
But that's because HMRC wasn't built to like go and find and break down these companies. In some ways, you guys are acting like tax vigilantes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're the Batman of the tax system trying to go and...
No, we're not. We're just really angry nerds. And yeah, we Tax Policy Associates...
Professor X.
We've got a bunch of people who... across the country, tax experts, people in big firms, people in small firms, and they see shit like this happening and they have a burning sense of injustice. Sometimes it's semi-selfish. Imagine you're an accountant in a small firm and one of your longtime clients, maybe a small businessman, is lured by someone promising a tax avoidance scheme, which you know is wrong and maybe even illegal, and you lose that client. So you're seeing something unjust and it's hurting you. And there's nothing you can do. Well, now there is something you can do because you can work with us and we can write about that scheme and we can try and expose it. So we have a bunch of really angry nerds with some of the best tax brains in the country who report on these schemes.
And how do you look out for these kind of dodgy schemes?
It's like really dodgy guys who set up company after company and make a lot of money. One of them, Douglas Bowerman, made hundreds of millions of pounds by doing this, now in the Isle of Man in a very large house, otherwise known as Mr. Baroness Moan.
They clapped for the NHS during the pandemic, just like the rest of us. But the former Tory peer, Baroness Moan, and her husband, Douglas Bowerman, wanted to do more than just clap. More than £200 million was paid to PPE MedPro. The consortium was led by Mr. Bowerman. His wife had recommended the company to ministers, but denied any involvement to the media. And Baroness Moan now admits she does stand to benefit from the millions the company made from PPE.
No way.
His money comes from tax avoidance schemes. And we reported that one of his schemes appeared to us to constitute criminal fraud against HMRC and against his own clients. Now, if you report that someone worth hundreds of millions of pounds may have committed fraud, what do you think will happen?
They're going to threaten you with libel.
Yeah, well, he didn't. Why do you think he didn't? Because it's true.
That couple, they've been up to some dodgy business. That is incredible. I mean, it's and then had access to the top people in power.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, that is just, this is, again, this is like, when people talk about lack of trust in our systems, I think completely justified, completely fair enough.
Here's another one. So how many people do you know who've been conned out of money by dodgy emails, dodgy text messages?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been one of those people.
Just in the last year, I know two people who've lost thousands of pounds to scams like that. People who are smart people. They don't work in finance, but they're, you know, they're smart people. And this is happening all over the country. You'd think this would be a massive political issue. You'd think the political parties would be competing to sell the best solution to low-level fraud. Silence.
Why is that, though?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of, my feeling is that there's a, you've got the Serious Fraud Office, who are really fucking good at their job, but they prosecute like 20 cases at a time. Yeah. You've got the police, who don't really have the ability or resources to do it. So it's almost like we've legalized low-level fraud. What we need is a not-that-serious fraud office, which is set up with a bunch of 20-something nerds with Facebook accounts who go hunting for scams, and a bunch of large policemen with large shoes who go around kicking doors down.
that's a sort of petty crime that is making people feel a sense of like this system.
Yeah, it's broken windows theory. You know, broken windows theory. The idea that if people are walking down a street and small crimes are being committed, broken windows, then criminals feel bolder and people in the public feel more vulnerable. Yeah. And we certainly have broken windows, but we have broken virtual windows. I look at my phone now and I got a WhatsApp message from someone saying, "Hi, Dad, how are you doing? I've just got a new mobile phone. Here's my number." My son is 11. He doesn't have a mobile phone.
Do you ever troll them? Do you ever like say like,
I do. 20 years ago, government could have said, right, we expect mobile phone companies to fix this. And if they don't fix it by such and such a date, they are jointly liable for people's losses. Bet there would have been a technological solution super quick time. It didn't happen. I believe there is a solution coming down the tracks on that, but don't hold your breath.
I have an impression of the private sector versus the public sector being a very asymmetrical battle. And what I mean by battle is that top level people are constantly getting incentivized to leave to the private sector because there aren't many people who would have gone into the Treasury who would have been able to retire at 51. That seems to me to be a massive problem because obviously we're aspirational. We want to make good money. But being in politics isn't really conducive to that unless you're a Tory and then like Rishi Sunak, you can end up at Goldman Sachs at the end of the day. But do you see what the point I'm making is that we've got a bit of a challenge here about how we fix the state. And I think good personnel is one of the main things that we need to start doing. But this money problem is like a huge sore.
I mean, no one ever got poached from HMRC to work for a big law firm. So that's like not a thing. The job is very different, but it's definitely a problem at the junior end. A newly qualified solicitor who knows nothing at a top firm paid 150 grand. How much has the Prime Minister paid?
165 or so.
What the fuck's going on there? And why is it that junior lawyers are paid so much? And the answer is the US firms opened up here, started paying lawyers New York wages, started paying them more to attract people from the big law firms. The other law firms have to compete. The inexorable logic of competition was therefore that you had a massive rise in the amount they were paid. And so whilst when I started, yeah, lawyers were paid more than teachers, not that much more. It worried me, it worried all of us as lawyers. All of us knew that it was mad to pay a newly qualified lawyer 150 grand. We had to do it. We didn't have a choice.
There is an element of compromise that some people are willing to take to sell the country down a drain at times, which I think is hugely problematic. And it does a fundamental damage to the quality of people that we're then attracting, because not that I think people should be paid inordinate amount to become MPs and politicians, but you want to attract the best and the brightest and people who are not going to be compromised to do the job of governing the society that we all live in, surely. And if a young lawyer that's 20 something coming out of uni that may have political aspirations, but realizes, oh, okay, I can get my nice house in London and I can earn 150 grand and I can do all of those things, but actually, if I'm going to go into politics, I'm earning almost half that.
In defense of Singapore, who I have added during this conversation, they did root out corruption and pay people in the public sector tons of money and then had a really high functioning government as a result of it. Like, it's never going to be a vote winner to say that people like MPs, in the public sector, they're not paid a lot of money. People think, I mean, obviously when the median wage is actually still quite a way out from an MP salary, that they're paid loads of money.
Oh God, we did some polling again. We asked people what they thought the three biggest areas of public spending were. A depressing number of people thought one of the three biggest areas was MPs' expenses. Which is like 0.001% of government spending or something like that. So yeah, we're not going to increase MPs' salaries. And that's kind of a problem.
The country is almost sold for the cost of someone's mortgage or the cost of 650 people's mortgages.
Or you attract only people who don't have to worry about mortgages.
Yeah, exactly. You know, take on 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 jobs.
I talked to lots of politicians in all parties. I went to see one the other day. I went to say which party. And arriving the same time as I was an intern from the States on some kind of exchange scheme. And they couldn't believe it. They'd been with a senator in the US who'd had a massive office with like 50 staff. And this MP had sort of two people and a PC that looked 20 years old.
No air conditioning in his office.
No air conditioning at all. Mice, if you look carefully, someone who's an investigator for HMRC could absolutely go and work for an accounting firm and be paid significantly more money. And it happens, and it's created a brain drain from HMRC. And that's really unfortunate. But are we going to be able to materially increase salaries of never mind MPs, but public sector workers like HMRC officials don't think so. It's really hard.
Like, you get a great pension, maybe you've got to take that money out of pensions, yeah, put them into income.
That's it, yeah. What young person says, no, don't pay me more money and salary, give me more pension 50 years' time? Who says that?
No one gives a shit about that. Yeah. I think that's one thing that we could do tomorrow that would change things. And there is something in the civil service reforms that are trying to kind of join up thinking across different sectors, get more alignment, as you were saying earlier, like this, yeah, when you were talking about the land value stuff, about aligning it with house building, etc. We need to get incentives. We've got crowd incentives right, yeah, now, but we also need entrepreneurial people who are, you know, think outside the box to be participating in these spaces. And it clearly isn't working right now based on the current conventions.
No, but we need entrepreneurialism everywhere. Pro-growth can't just be a mantra. It has to be something that you do. So you need, again, like with house building, look across the tax system. What are the areas of the tax system that hold back growth? And can we change them? There are people who think we should tax highest earners at 60%. Fine, that's I don't agree, but it's a rational view. I don't think there's anyone who thinks that you should tax people who earn 100 grand at 62%, but tax people who earn 125 grand at 47%. No one believes that. That's the tax system we have. It's mad. VAT, a VAT system full of holes, full of special cases. Corporation tax, enormously complicated rules built up over years. You could go through them with a razor, not lose a pound of revenue, make a more efficient pro-growth system, and so on and so on. You keep going. It's about whether you have the will. Tax, it's politicians for the last few years, the last 20 years, have just regarded tax as a tap. You can turn it on, raise more money. Turn it off, tax cuts. Yay, popularity. But tax is much more than that. Tax shapes everyone's incentive in the economy. It controls growth to a very large degree. It directs growth. It switches some things off. It switches other things on. And if you just let the tax system ossify over the years and never step back, never reform, then you are damaging the UK. And that's what's happened. That's been what's happening. You need some politicians to devote political capital to pro-growth tax reform. Not to raise money. You can do that as well. But pro-growth tax reform for its own sake.
On that note, Dan Needle, thank you so much for your time. I feel like we have more clarity now, yes, about what the hell is going wrong with our system, but maybe not yet the solutions about who's going to have the balls to change it.
Well, follow me on Twitter, Dan Needle. Subscribe to the Tax Policy Associates website. Check out Untaxing on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. How's
thank
that?
You. Thank you so much.
Thank you so thank much. You.